Welcome to Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. I'm Scott Burry, here in the Redbeard studio on traditional Anishinaabeg Algonquin territory, also known as Ottawa, Canada. Before we get into the episode, I'd like to remind you that you can support this podcast through Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and choose the level of support you prefer. This is episode 46 of Beyond Barbarossa, Holocaust and Uprising. As you know by now, this podcast is trying to more or less track the history of the Eastern Front chronologically with an 81-year delay. So since we started on 21st June 2022, which was 81 years to the day after the launch of Operation Barbarossa itself, we've now arrived at the spring of 1943. And I hope you're all having a wonderful spring. Most of you by now, given all the news from that sector of the world, have heard of the Bezdorizhia, or in Russian, Rasputitsa, the season of no roads in Russia and Ukraine. When the spring and fall turned the rich black earth of Ukraine into an impassable mire that swallows cars, trucks, other vehicles, even men. But that did not mean that there was nothing happening on the Eastern Front, nor elsewhere in the war. So while last episode was full of movement, because the ground was frozen hard, this episode is going to look behind the lines a little bit, the lines which now aren't moving that much. We're going to look into the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising and the factors that led up to it, specifically the oppression of Jews and other minorities in Nazi Germany, and the developing Holocaust across Europe. Our focus is going to remain chronological, which means before we go any further in the Eastern Front, we need to look at what else is happening in the war in the spring of 1943. In Africa, British forces under General Bernard Montgomery break through the Axis forces at the Marath Line. The German and Italian forces withdraw north into a shrinking corner of Tunisia. By 7th April, British forces advancing westward meet up with American forces coming east near the town of Gafsa, Tunisia. In the Pacific, on 4th April, 10 American POWs and 2 Filipino prisoners break out of the Davao penal colony on Mindanao in the Philippines. This, the only so-called large-scale escape of POWs in the Pacific War, 12 men, brings back news to the Allies of Japanese atrocities like the Bataan Death March. On 18 April, American fighter planes shoot down the transport plane of Japanese Admiral Yamamoto, the architect of the Japanese war strategy, killing him. In the Atlantic, in mid-March, the Allies suffer huge losses of shipping in the mid-Atlantic to German U-boats. Despite the advances in sonar, patrols, and escorts, the middle of the ocean remains out of range for most aircraft patrols, and thus is especially vulnerable. At the end of April, the Allies attempt to deal with this with long-range bombers. Springtime 1943 is a time of many meetings among the leaders of the two sides in the war, which makes sense. As I've said a number of times in the past several months, the previous 9 to 12 months have seen several major turning points in the war, in every theater of operation. In short, the initiative and the tide seems to have shifted from the Axis to the Allies. On 7th April, Hitler and Mussolini meet face-to-face in Salzburg to discuss, well, the Italians' long string of miserable losses over the past 3 years, which have started to bum out Mussolini. From the 19th to the 30th of April, so a long meeting, American President Franklin Roosevelt and UK Prime Minister Winston Churchill meet in Hamilton, Bermuda, to discuss the oppression of the Jews living and dying under Nazi rule. In Europe, there are a number of telling signs of the major trends of the second half of the Second World War happening all at the same time, all at once. On 13 April, German radio announces the discovery of mass graves of the Katyn massacre in Poland, when the Soviet security police, the NKVD, massacred hundreds of Polish POWs after the USSR's invasion in September 1939. The USSR denies responsibility. On 18 April, three members of the Belgian resistance stop a train bound for the Auschwitz concentration camp, freeing 17 Jews. Others escaped by jumping from the train. Of the 1,631 Jewish men, women, and children on the train, in total, 233 escape as a result of the resistance attack and also because the train's driver keeps the speed as low as he can get away with. This allows the prisoners to jump off. Of the 233 escapers, 26 are killed rather quickly either by the fall or by being shot by the guards. 118 survive. This was the only mass escape from so-called Holocaust trains of the war. I linger on this event because in spring 1943, the Holocaust, the wholesale murder of people, was really getting moving in Nazi-occupied Europe. The train attacked by the Belgian resistance was the 20th mass transportation of Belgian Jews to Auschwitz, which was in Nazi-occupied Poland. That's the part of Poland that became the epicenter of the Holocaust, the murder of millions of Jews, Romani, and many other people by the Nazis. And that leads us into the central story of this episode, the Holocaust and the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, which took place from 19 April to 16 May 1943. To understand that issue, we need to back up a little bit. Well, quite a bit. That's too slow. Good. We've backed up to the Nazis coming to power in 1933. So, 10 years. That was a fast tape rewind. From that point, 1933, persecution of Germany's Jewish population became a matter of government policy. Of course, before that, the Nazis had persecuted Jewish people all along. It was part of their raison d'être. With power, the Nazis accelerated their persecution and killing. They began building concentration camps in 1933 for communists and other opponents. In 1937, the Nazis rounded up thousands of Romani or so-called gypsy people and sent them to concentration camps like Dachau, Buchenwald, Ravensbrück, and others. After the Anschluss with Austria in March 1938, basically the day that Germany swallowed up Austria, the Nazis established so-called central offices for Jewish emigration. The night of 9 to 10 November 1938 is infamous as Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass, when Nazi paramilitaries and others smashed homes, businesses, schools, synagogues, and hospitals owned by Jewish people. More than 90 people were killed, and 30,000 Jewish men were arrested and sent to concentration camps, I guess for the crime of having their house destroyed. Now, at this point, Hitler's thinking seems to have been to expel Jewish people from Europe, or at least the part of Europe he controlled. There were plans on paper that the Nazis drew up to send German Jews to Madagascar, South America, even to Palestine. But then came Hitler's speech to the Reichstag on 30th January 1939. It was actually given in the Kroll Opera House, as the Reichstag building had been burned down in 1933. In this speech, Hitler predicted, quote, the annihilation of the Jewish race in Europe, end quote, if there would be another world war. Because, in his thinking, the world war would be, like the first one, the Jews' fault. Then came the annexation of the Sudetenland part of Czechoslovakia in October 1938, followed quickly by the complete occupation of Czechoslovakia in March 1939, and then the invasion of Poland in September 1939. That event led to the partition of Poland between Germany and the USSR, according to the Nazi-USSR Non-Aggression Pact. This was the start of the Holocaust in Poland. As the Nazis closed in, they killed thousands of Poles not only in battle, but they also executed 45,000 Polish civilians, including Jews. SS death squads called Einsatzgruppen machine-gunned patients in mental institutions. Then the Nazis began a systematic program to destroy the Polish culture, closing schools and universities, deporting professors and priests, and forcing Polish men and women into slavery. The Soviets, when they took Eastern Poland under the terms of the Non-Aggression Pact with Germany, executed tens of thousands of Polish soldiers and civilians. That was the Katyn massacre, among others. The following February, so that's 1940, the Soviets began deporting hundreds of thousands of Poles to gulags in Siberia and Central Asia. Those are concentration camps too. The Nazis' next step was to force Jewish people to live in specific sections of towns and cities, what are known today as ghettos. Hitler's idea, nebulous as always, never really thought through, was that removing Jewish and Slavic people would free up living space, Lebensraum, for German people. According to Anthony Beevor in his book, The Second World War, quote, although Hitler never wavered in his hatred of the Jews, the industrial genocide, which began in 1942, had not always been part of his plan. He exulted in his obsessive anti-Semitism and established the Nazi mindset that Europe had to be cleansed of all Jewish influence. But his plans before the war had not included a murderous annihilation. They had concentrated on creating an unbearable oppression which would force Jews to emigrate. End quote. So while the explicit policy of mass murder had not been uttered yet or not been written down yet by Hitler or the officials, the Nazi hierarchy certainly condoned murder of Jews. 3.5 million Jewish Poles were stuffed into those little areas called the ghettos without any provision for adequate housing or even food and water. Starvation and epidemic disease broke out. Final solution. Following Operation Barbarossa in the summer of 1941, that gigantic invasion by Germany of the USSR, the head of the SS, Heinrich Himmler, ordered that all Jews in the Soviet territory they now occupied should be, quote, regarded as partisans, end quote. In other words, killed immediately. Some death squad SS officers began to try more efficient ways to kill large numbers of people because they were dealing with large numbers of people. So they tried things like feeding exhaust fumes into sealed vans. Near Lublin in occupied Poland, the SS began setting up an extermination camp. I'll quote once again from Anthony Beevor's book, The Second World War. Quote, Nazi policy on the Jewish question had fluctuated. In fact, the very term policy is misleading when one considers the institutional disorder of the Third Reich. Hitler's dismissive attitude towards administration permitted an extraordinary proliferation of competing departments and ministries. Their rivalries, especially those between the Gauleiters and other Nazi party officials, the SS and the army, produced an astonishingly wasteful lack of cohesion, which was totally at variance with the regime's image of ruthless efficiency. Seizing on a random comment from the Führer or trying to second-guess his wishes, competitors for his favor would initiate programs without consulting other interested organizations. End quote. In other words, the Nazis' eagerness to eliminate Jews created a chaotic approach to eliminating Jewish and other undesirable people, And this chaos did not fit with the Nazi self-image as rational, organized, and efficient. Which brings us to the final solution. Introducing Himmler's deputy, Reinhard Heydrich, the top of the Reich Security main office. On 31 July 1941, so a month into Operation Barbarossa, he received a document signed by Hermann Göring. And actually, it appears that he had it drafted and then sent through channels to get signed. But anyway, this document gave him authority to, quote, undertake by emigration or evacuation a solution of the Jewish question, end quote. It also made Heydrich responsible for, quote, all necessary organizational, functional, and material preparations for a complete solution of the Jewish question in the German sphere of influence in Europe, end quote. About a month later, so here at the end of August 1941, Heydrich told his deputy, Adolf Eichmann, in charge of the SS department responsible for Jewish affairs, that Himmler had received Hitler's instruction to begin the, quote, physical annihilation of the Jews, end quote. Now, this may sound like third-hand information, right? Hey, Adolf, my boss told me from his boss to do this. It may seem plausible that Heydrich made this up, because like all orders about the final solution at this stage, they weren't written down. So it seems plausible that Heydrich was acting on his own initiative here. He was known as probably the most ruthless anti-Semite in Nazi Germany, which is saying a lot. Hitler himself once described Heydrich as, quote, the man with the iron heart, end quote. But Anthony Beaver writes, quote, it would be unthinkable in this case that Himmler or Heydrich would have dared to do so on quite so important a matter, end quote. Heydrich organized a conference of senior government officials and SS leaders. Of course he organized a conference. He was, after all, a bureaucrat. Anyway, he organizes, gets all these Nazis in army, military, SS, and bureaucracies together in a rather nice, or say very nice palace in a suburb of Berlin called Wannsee on 20th January 1942. Now remember, the timing here. In December 1941, so a month earlier, the USSR had launched a huge winter counterattack that drove the Wehrmacht back from Moscow about 100 miles. On December 7th, Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, and the next day, Hitler declared war on the United States. And Hitler said this in the declaration, quote, the instigators of this bloody conflict, that is, according to Hitler, the Jews, remember, will thus have to pay for it with their lives, end quote. Anyway, back to the story. At this conference, attendees included the security service, of course, the SS, senior officers from occupied territories, and heads of key ministry. The final solution to the Jewish question, it turns out, required cooperation and coordination of several branches of government, including what passed for justice among these monsters, transportation, finance, and the foreign ministry. Heydrich presented a plan that dealt with the fate of about 11 million Jewish people across Europe, and this plan included Jewish people in Britain. And it called for them to be, quote, evacuated to the east. Their numbers would be, quote, whittled down through hard labor, then treated accordingly, end quote. Tellingly, the minutes of the meeting, the written down record, does not mention murder, killing, or elimination. Just uses words like evacuation and resettlement. Still, the meeting agreed, somehow without uttering the words aloud, or at least not recording them in any way, that Germany would go ahead with mass murder organized on an industrial scale. And with that foreshadowing, it's time to take a short break. Hi, Scott here. I hope you're enjoying this episode and that you get a lot out of the whole podcast. Beyond Barbarossa is still, as far as I can tell, the only English language podcast in the world that focuses on the Eastern Front of World War II. If you do like it and you want to help me keep it going, please give it a rating or a review on Apple, Google, Amazon, Podbean, or whatever podcasting platform you listen to it on. That helps let other people know about it. Patreon's another way you can support the podcast, my research, and podcasting expenses. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and sign up at whatever level of support you choose. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free access to new episodes, as well as exclusive bonus episodes on topics like the Winter War between the USSR and Finland, and the pre-Barbarossa invasion of Poland by Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union in 1939. Check it out, won't you? Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Thanks.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more about my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel. And all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now let's get back to Scott exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Thanks for coming back. We've been talking about the transportation of Jewish people from occupied areas in Europe, occupied by the Nazis, eastward, and the development of the final solution to the Jewish question, so-called, at the Wannsee Conference in January 1942. So how did the plans developed at the Wannsee Conference actually play out? Well, going back again just a bit, after the fall of France in 1940, German occupation authorities began pressuring their conquered territories in Western Europe to send the Jewish communities eastward for, quote, resettlement, unquote. This began the program of what's now called Holocaust trains, which shipped Jewish people under the pretense that they would be resettled in, quote, the East, end quote. The first trains carried Jewish people from Germany to Poland in October 1941. In Western and Central Europe, the trains were usually third-class passenger carriages, but in Eastern Europe, the Nazis used freight cars or cattle cars, each carrying up to 150 people with little ventilation, no food nor water, and a bucket for a toilet. Often, when the trains arrived at their final destination in eastern Poland, everyone on board was already dead. Oh, and just to make it better, the deportees themselves had to pay for the train ticket. The Reichsbahn, the German railway network, is calculated to have taken in, through this method, over 600 million US dollars worth of Reichsmarks by 1945. So, following that Wannsee Conference at the beginning of 1942, transportation to extermination camps ramped up. In Poland, where the program really began, the Holocaust trains shipped people from the ghettos, those small areas in the cities that the Nazis had designated as the only places where Jewish people could live, and took them from there to the death camps of Belze, Majdanek, Sobibor, and Treblinka in what was called Operation Reinhard, I guess named for Heydrich. In total, the operation murdered 1,850,000 men, women, and children. More than 108,000 Jews from Germany were transported east. because many hundreds of thousands, if not millions, had fled for other countries before the war. From Western Europe, they took 25,437 people from Belgium. The Netherlands, 100,000 sent to Auschwitz-Birkenau and Sobibor camps. Vichy France deported more than 76,000 of its own citizens to concentration and extermination camps. Less than 3% of them survived. 8,000 were transported and killed from Italy after the fall of Mussolini and the subsequent occupation of at least half the country by Germany. Up to 65,000 Jews from Greece were sent to the camps. Denmark managed to sneak all of its Jewish population, which admittedly wasn't very big, by boat to Sweden under dark of night. Half of the Jews of Norway, which in total before the war was about less than 1,800, half of them escaped to Sweden. The Quisling collaborationist government deported 770 to Germany over the course of the occupation. Only 24 of them survived. From Slovakia, the puppet state severed from the Czechoslovakian Republic following the Nazi seizure of the country, 74,000 were sent to the death camps. From Bohemia-Moravia, the remainder of Czech, and the area administered by Heydrich himself until his assassination in June 1942 by Czech partisans, 80,000, or three quarters of the pre-war Jewish population, were murdered. And from Hungary, 565,000 Jewish people were killed. Not all were transported. 50,000 died as slave laborers, worked to death. 320,000 Hungarian Jews were killed at Auschwitz-Birkenau before July 1944. In the camps, Heydrich's industrial murder operation developed a few different methods of mass murder. In some cases, they put prisoners into sealed vans and directed exhaust fumes into them. In others, the Nazis built special gas chambers. At Auschwitz, they used Zyklon B hydrogen cyanide in their gas chambers. But not all the prisoners or deportees were gassed this way. The SS Einsatzgruppen shot millions of people. For example, in July 1942, in the town of Bereza Kartuza, Belarusia, an SS Einsatzgruppe marched 1,300 Jewish men, women, and children out of the town, forced them to undress completely, and shot each one in the back of the head, then took their clothes for disinfection and reuse. In other towns and cities, police and SS units raided homes at night or before dawn to round up Jewish families. If people tried to hide under the floorboards, the SS men tossed in hand grenades. The murderers took the people out of the cities to be shot and dumped in pits and trenches outside the cities, often forcing the prisoners to dig such trenches themselves. Some of the deportees were buried alive, and a few managed to dig themselves out. The Nazis, understandably, took pains to keep all of this secret. But this operation required tens of thousands of people to make it work. And many in Germany and in occupied Europe made money from confiscating the victims' property and apartments. So, inevitably, word leaked out. Some Jewish people did resist, escaping the ghettos to join partisan groups in the countryside. That brings us to Warsaw in the spring of 1943. Between 1939 and 1941, the Warsaw Ghetto, the area designated for Jewish people in Warsaw, had grown to 450,000 people, stuffed into an area previously housing 60,000. More than seven times the number. But by January 1943, so many had been deported to the camps or otherwise killed, only 70,000 were left. And the Nazis had this macabre policy of eliminating the elderly and sick first. So that meant that most of the 70,000 left in the Warsaw Ghetto at this point were younger and comparatively healthy. And because word had been leaking out, they knew what the Nazi plan was. their complete eradication. So the disparate political groups decided to work together, including the leftist Jewish combat organization, ZOB, and the right-wing Jewish military union, ZZW, or for my American listeners, that's ZOB and ZZW. They got weapons and ammunition from the Polish Home Army, Armia Krajowa, which answered to the Polish government in exile in London. They also got supplies from the Polish communist resistance, which was being financed and run from Moscow. The ZOB and ZZW killed collaborators and prepared defensive positions in the ghetto. Their first action came in January 1943, when the SS tried to round up 6,000 to 8,000, depending on your source, more inhabitants of the ghetto for deportation. So these newly armed, young, mostly men, killed a dozen soldiers and wounded many more, driving the Germans away. But they also suffered heavy losses. In total, some 1,200 Jewish people were killed in this operation. The SS deported about another 5,000, less than they planned, but that's still a lot of people. In response, Himmler ordered the Warsaw Ghetto leveled. It took the SS a while to get organized for this, and in the meantime, the ZOB and ZZW built up defensive bunkers and fighting posts. They also executed more collaborators, police officers, Gestapo, and military intelligence officers. On 19 April, the day before Passover, Waffen-SS troops entered the ghetto and loaded prisoners onto cattle wagons. The resistors met them with heavy gunfire and Molotov cocktails. Suffering several casualties, the SS retreated when Molotov cocktails destroyed their armored cars. When he heard about this fiasco from the Nazis' point of view, Himmler fired the unit's commander, replacing him with SS Brigade Commander Jürgen Stroop. Under his command, the SS changed tactics, systematically destroying houses and other buildings with flamethrowers and also blowing up basements and sewers, which the resistors were using as access routes and hideouts. The fighting continued for a month, but the Jews of the ghetto did not fight alone. Non-Jewish Polish resistance groups attacked the Germans repeatedly between the 19th and 23rd of April. Still, the methodical Germans wore them down. By 29 April, all the commanders from the ZZW/ZZW group were dead. That's the right-wing group. The survivors escaped through a tunnel to a forest outside the city. Thousands of surviving Jews in the ghetto tried to hide in the sewers and the remaining bunkers, those that hadn't been blown up and burned down. The SS brought in dogs to sniff them out and then flushed them out with smoke bombs or flooded the basements and sewers with water. On 8th May, the Germans closed in on the ZOB, the left-wing group's command post. Those inside committed suicide. A few more kept fighting until 16th May. Then the SS took all the surviving denizens of the razed ghetto prisoner. Soviet war journalist Vasily Grossman came to Warsaw with the Red Army in January 1945, nearly 2 years later. And he described the city this way. Quote, "Waves of stone, crushed bricks, a sea of brick. There isn't a single wall intact. The beast's anger was terrible." End quote. The resistors in the Warsaw Ghetto knew from the outset that they had no hope of freeing themselves from the Nazis. Some sources say they were trying to restore their honor. At any rate, after the fighting, the Nazis took all the survivors as prisoners. They executed 7,000 on the spot. Then they sent the rest, nearly 50,000, to the camp at Treblinka to be gassed. A few were turned over to forced labor, where they were worked to death. And thus, the Warsaw Ghetto uprising ended as its participants knew it would, with their death. But their memory lives on. That's a heavy note to end an episode, but end we must. Come back in 2 weeks when we'll continue our chronological journey through the Eastern Front of World War II. Thank you for listening to Beyond Barbarossa, the podcast about the Eastern Front of the Second World War. For a better understanding of the progress of the war, please see the maps and photos on the website beyondbarbarossa.ca or beyondbarbarossa.podbean.com. You can also listen to the episode on my own website, writtenword.ca. Just click on the podcast button in the banner. If you like this episode, consider following Beyond Barbarossa on your preferred podcasting app. And I'd really appreciate a rating on whatever podcasting platform you listen. That really helps spread the word to others who are interested in history and haven't heard of this podcast yet. And if you'd like to support this podcast, just one more reminder that you can support it through Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Choose whatever level of support that you're comfortable with. Do you have any thoughts, questions, ideas, comments, or perhaps corrections? I hope I haven't made any errors, but I probably have. So reach out by email at contact@beyondbarbarossa.ca or through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Burry. I'm Scott Burry. Until next episode, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraini.